Our next case for argument this morning is United States against Dimitrov. Beals.
May it please the Court, Your Honor. I'm Barry Beals on behalf of Stefan Dimitrov. Your Honors, I would present two arguments today from of the three that were contained in the brief. Specifically, the argument that the district court erred in granting the government's motion in limine, as well as the statute 18 U.S.C. 1960 is an improper delegation of the United States Congress legislative powers to the state assemblies or state legislative bodies authority.
Before you do that, could you just tell me approximately how much money Dimitrov transferred through TCF Bank before receiving the first letter inquiring into his licensing status?
Your Honors, I don't have the exact approximate. I know that it was several hundreds of thousands of dollars before receiving the actual letter. And Mr. Dimitrov never contested the facts that he did operate a business that did transfer money outside of the state of Illinois to Bulgaria. As a matter of fact, he operated the business openly and notoriously, so he never contested those facts.
And I have one other sort of factual question. Did he have a general Illinois business license before he began transmitting money, or did he obtain that license after he was already in operation and transmitting money?
Well, he had a general business license. I do believe it was from the city of Chicago. It wasn't an Illinois license. It was from the city of Chicago. And he received that license sometime after 2000. It was prior to 2003 that the indictment period covers, but it was after he had started his business and during a process of time. This is something, because this does not go to trial, this is not something that's contained in the record. It's my understanding that it was, as he started his business, he inquired and he was directed to that he needed a business license, and that's the business license he received. But that is outside the record because there was no trial in this matter. Mr. Dimitrov pled guilty.
So I take it that the requirements in Illinois to obtain a money transmitting license are also not in the record. I was wondering if they were onerous.
No, the requirements are not in the record. It's my understanding there is an application that's required. There was some discussion regarding what is required to get a license that was at the sentencing phase. It's my understanding there is an application process, and the process I wouldn't quite call it onerous, but it is more elaborate than going to the city of Chicago and getting a general business license.
Okay.
As it pertains to the delegation argument, the government in his brief raised an argument that Mr. Dimitrov had waived the delegation argument. But if you look, and they pointed to the agreed statement of facts, but if you look at the record, specifically in the plea transcripts on page 9, it's starting at line 4, through line 5 is specifically, as I was addressing the court, the district court, specifically stated that my client wants to preserve any issues regarding the constitutionality of the statute. Furthermore,
how does that help?
Well, how that helps
is not what he wants to reserve, but what the prosecutor agreed that he could reserve.
Your Honor,
the conditional plea requires the consent of both litigants, the defendant and the prosecutor, and the district court. So where is it that we can go in the record to find that the prosecutor and the district judge agreed that this delegation issue could be reserved for appeal?
Your Honor, it appears that I'm going into my rebuttal time, but I would like to answer your question. The case was the plea was it occurred after the motion in limine had been granted, so it was actually a rather fluid situation. The agreed statement of facts there was a period of negotiation, but a part of the waiver, the waiver argument, as I understand it, the government gave, was that a waiver is an intentional relinquishment of a right. There was no intent to relinquish the broad basis to.
Could you address the question the way I asked it? Rule 11A says that conditional plea requires the consent of everybody, defendant, prosecutor, and court. So I want to know where in the record we can find that the court and the prosecutor have agreed that this particular issue can be raised on appeal.
Well, Your Honor, I don't think that there actually is anything in the record that specifically points to where there was an agreement between the actual my client and the government.
I don't see where we get, right? If you just read Rule 11A2, it begins with the consent of the court and the government. So the proposition my client said on the record that he wanted to appeal Issue X doesn't help.
Well, it does point to, first and foremost, there were no objections by the government. Sure. Let
me try one more way. Rule 11A2 says this has to be done in writing.
Yes, Your Honor, I understand.
In order to avoid this kind of thing. So where in the record is the written conditional plea agreement?
Well, Your Honor, that's the point. There was just agreed statement of facts. The government is arguing that's functionally the written.
Statement of facts doesn't do it. 11A2 says reserving in writing the right to have an appellate court review an adverse determination of a specified pretrial motion. Without such a reservation in writing, if you say there's no such thing, then I think we have to dismiss the whole appeal outright. You haven't reserved right to appeal anything. A statement of facts doesn't satisfy 11A2. There's got to be this written agreement. We've got to be able to find it someplace.
Well, in this case, Your Honor, there is no specific written agreement regarding Rule 11.
I think we have to dismiss the appeal for lack of jurisdiction on everything.
Well, Your Honor, I do believe that the court has at times looked at the actual when there isn't an actual written agreement as to a conditional plea.
If no written agreement, then nothing has been preserved for appeal.
Well, I do believe
it says.
Yes, Your Honor, I do believe that. It's my saying that the court has at times looked at the actual transcripts to look at through the intention of the defendant and making a conditional plea.
But see, here's the problem. Your brief doesn't argue that your legislative power argument is preserved for argument on appeal. And there was no reply brief, so there's no response to the government's contention that the argument has been waived.
Well, Your Honor, that is true. There was no reply brief, but in this case, my brief also does contain the notice of appeal regarding this case, in which case, in the notice of appeal, that was one of the things that was, it was a very broad a notice of appeal regarding the constitutionality of the actual statute. What is also included, as I point to, although the court may or may not find that persuasive, the actual plea transcripts, where it's made clear in the transcripts that my client intended to enter into a conditional plea, and the basis and reason for his plea, as well as a clear intent to challenge the constitutionality of the statute.
Did Judge Shader ever say anywhere, "I am accepting this plea as a conditional plea"?
Yes, Your Honor, I do believe that was. If you can ask the court's indulgence. Early, as I point out in the first part of the transcripts, There was a discussion regarding my client pleading guilty based on the motion in limine being granted, and also with a desire to challenge the constitutionality of the statute. At that point in the transcript, it shows that there were some discussions between me and the government regarding what eventually came up with agreed statement of facts. I see my time has expired, but if it pleases the court, I would.
Mr. Beals.
Thank you.
Ms. Morrissey.
May it please the court. My name is Megan Morrissey. I'm an assistant United States attorney, and I represent the plaintiff appellee in this matter. The government asks that this court affirm defendant Stefan.
Well, Ms. Morrissey, is there a written agreement satisfying 11A2?
There is, Your Honor. I direct the court to page A13 of the defendant's brief, his appendix specifically. The document entitled Agreed Statement of Facts is the equivalent of a conditional guilty plea. I direct, Your Honor, specifically to the third paragraph, which states, the defendant enters his guilty plea preserving the right to object to the constitutionality and construction of Title 18 U.S.C. Section 1960 as it relates to the mental state required to be in violation of the law.
And where do we find the agreement of, as the rule says, the consent of the court and the government?
The government indicated its agreement by signing at the bottom of this document, and if you review the transcripts from this date, I believe then the court conducted a change of plea hearing upon reviewing this document.
And where do we find Judge Shader's consent?
Your Honor, I believe that because Judge Shader went on to then accept the defendant's guilty plea, enter the defendant's guilty plea, that evidences his consent to this document. And Your Honor, it's the government's position that this conditional guilty plea specifically, by its very language, preserves only the right to appeal issues relating to the mental state required to be in violation of the law. It does not preserve any arguments regarding improper delegation as it relates to Section 1960. As noted in the government's brief, this improper delegation argument was raised, in fact, by the district court many months after the defendant's guilty plea was entered. And so for all those reasons, under Rule 11, it's the government's position that this conditional plea does not preserve that improper delegation argument, that the government did not consent to a conditional guilty plea preserving that particular argument. However, if this court were to find that the improper delegation argument was preserved by appeal, the government believes that's not a meritorious argument. As the government's brief mentioned, several courts have rejected improper delegation arguments directed at federal gambling statutes that incorporate provisions of state law. Courts have held that federal statutes directed at instruments of interstate commerce may properly incorporate elements of state law to define the limits of prescribed conduct under those statutes. In this case, Section 1960B1A, by its terms, is clearly directed at money-transmitting businesses that affect interstate or foreign commerce in any manner or degree.
Has the Supreme Court, by the way, ever dealt directly with the constitutionality of piggyback jurisdiction statutes?
I don't know the answer to that question, Your Honor.
There are an awful lot of them, of course, RICO perhaps being the most famous. Doesn't strike me that the Supreme Court has ever addressed them. There are a lot of responsible people who had had questions about them, but it doesn't look like we get there in this case.
Yeah, I'm certainly not aware of any Supreme Court holdings finding that this, as you termed it, piggyback jurisdiction is unconstitutional. I can represent that to the court. And again, Your Honor, the specific terms of Section 1960 rely on state law to define the limits of prescribed conduct under the statute, and that is the operation of a money-transmitting business that violates a state law directed at such businesses. And if I may move on to the remainder of defendant's arguments, defendant argues that the Section 1960 is impermissibly vague so as to be a violation of the defendant's due process rights. It's the government's position that this statute is entirely unambiguous. There is no doubt that the statute contains a mens rea as to the factual elements of this crime. It requires defendant to knowingly conduct a money-transmitting business. The legislative history indicates that Congress specifically intended to exclude a requirement that the defendant knew his money-transmitting business had to be licensed under state law. And in fact, defendant concedes that point in his brief. As the court in Telebnahad has held, the Due Process Clause does not require Congress to include a mens rea as to certain legal elements of crimes, as long as the factual elements of the crime require a mens rea of knowing conduct, then this statute is entirely constitutional. And with respect to a question raised by Judge Rovner to defendant, Judge Rovner, I would point out that the requirements for to obtain an Illinois money transmitting license are, in fact, in the record. I direct you to the testimony of Phil Sansone of the Illinois Department of Financial Institutions. His testimony is referred to on page 6 of the government's brief. During that testimony, Mr. Sansone laid out the extensive requirements that exist to obtain a money-transmitting license in the state of Illinois. That includes things like the filing of extensive financial statements, histories on the proprietors of the business, certain requirements with respect to bonds and insurance, anti-money laundering regulations for the business, et cetera. So I think that the requirements are, in keeping with the fact that it's a sort of a financial institution, a financial business, the requirements are quite extensive and particular. So unless the panel has any further questions for the government rests on its brief and asks that this court affirm the defendant's conviction. Thank you.
I don't know.
Thank you. Mr. Beals, we asked you a lot of questions, so I'll give you 1 minute for rebuttal if you have any.
Just to address one of the issues that I was not able to address earlier regarding the court's granting of the motion in limine, just quickly, if you look at the statute, it says there's a knowingly that modifies much of the actual factual part of Section A of the statute. It is my argument that the knowingly, since it does modify the Section A of 18 U.S.C. 1960, it does apply in the rare situation, as with Mr. Dimitrov's situation, where someone has a generic business license but don't know that they have the improper license. So in this case, my client wanted to present those facts at trial as a defense. The government filed a motion in limine that effectively says that defense, that information should be precluded because the statute does not allow for that defense that it was a general intent crime, and therefore the district court agreed with that and granted their motion in limine. And I would ask that the court overturn that ruling and that Mr. Dimitrov is allowed to have a trial.
I do have a question. Is what you believe to be Judge Shader's Judge Shader's agreeing to this form of guilty plea, where in transcript volume 2 of 5, where he says, how then, because I find that the elements have been established, how then do you plead to this charge, guilty or not guilty, understanding that if your choice is to plead guilty, that you are reserving and preserving the right to take an appeal on the issues that we have discussed? Is that what you're talking about at page 33?
In addition to what the government already stated regarding the agreed statement of facts, although I don't necessarily agree that that it forecloses the delegation argument. But in addition to that, yes, the court did on the record, and I do believe, I'm turning to that right now, that was after the agreed statement of facts had been presented to the court, and the court made it plain that that they were accepting my client's conditional guilty plea.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.